Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're talking about same-sex arguments, the arguments made in favor of same-sex marriage. You're hearing them, you're reading them in op-ed pieces, you're hearing them on television, from the pundits, from everyone, from politicians as well. How do you respond to these things? Do you have some that we haven't covered yet in the first hour of our conversation with Greg Kokel? Feel free to give us a call, 1-800-730-2727. If you call now, you get a busy signal, but we're going to be freeing up phone lines here in just a moment, 1-800-730-2727. If you'd like to, you can also post a question or a comment at our forum. Our Issues Etc. forum is found at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. The forum is there. Our guest, Greg Kokel, is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-authored the book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
Let's talk with Milana. She calls from Kansas City. Milana, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Greg. How are you?
Hi, Milana. I'm fine. Thanks.
My question was, have we as Christians destroyed God's intention of marriage through our disobedience, through divorce, through infidelity? I mean, just allow children to raise themselves when there are people who want to raise and love them, gay, single, straight, etc.? I mean, how we have to really hold ourselves accountable and not allow our children to suffer.
Yeah, Milana, this is a great point. It makes it very difficult for Christians to take the high moral ground against homosexuality when their own behavior has been inconsistent with what God's revealed. As you mentioned, you know, your divorce rate, children not being taught and taken care of, you've got adultery and sexual sin within the body of Christ, and then all of a sudden we really care about morality when it comes to homosexuality. We make a big fuss about that, and people think, well, this is a bit disingenuous, isn't it?
Yes, I believe so. I think we have to hold ourselves accountable. I mean, there's too many logs, and we're pointing at sties.
That's a great observation. That certainly is true, and it makes it much more difficult. Now, we have to make the moral case, as we've been making, because this move towards same-sex marriage is going to be debilitating, I think, to our culture in undermining the value of marriage ultimately and the families that come forth from it. I think ultimately this is about again, the next generation. And for the last 20 years, the changes in marriage with no-fault divorce and latchkey children and all of that other stuff has really, really had a powerful impact on the next generation, and it's hurt us terribly.
Milana, thank you very much for the call. Greg, in connection with that, and very briefly, you talked about there being a need for parents. All children need two parents.
A mom and a dad, yeah.
Right. But you say mom and a bad dad, but some people say, now look, why not a homosexual couple? Because they can be as loving, because they do love one another, because they're committed, and because they do love their children. We don't want to impugn their love for their children. Why not?
Virtually every mother and father loves their children. That doesn't make them a good parent. There's more that's required for effective parenthood than just love. There needs to be a proper contribution to the life of the child. Children are the product in the natural state, and you could argue this theologically or just in terms of the natural order, however you want to do this. They are the product of a mother and a father. There's a reason for this. It's because human children need a mother and father for the bulk of their life to train them up properly. Now, it is possible for a single parent to do a good job raising their child, but ask any good single parent, and they will tell you, and my wife was a single parent for 16 years, did a wonderful job with her son, but it was hard, and it's hardly ideal. And therefore, even though there are exceptional cases where people who are single parents can do a good job raising their children, we would hardly want to not only normalize that or naturalize that, but make it part of our legal system and essentially say by law, and this would be the case if we have same-sex marriage, saying by law that children have no right to a mother and a father, and any old two people will do. It's just not sound, and you don't need a sociologist report to tell you that. Just observing the natural order should be good enough.
Paul is calling from Springfield, Missouri. Paul, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi,
Paul.
One thing I haven't heard discussed anywhere, either on your show or any other show, is the inevitable. I mean, if regular marriages end in 50% in divorce, why do the why do homosexuals think their marriages are going to fare any better? And are we ready to clutter up a legal system that's already cluttered up with gay divorces?
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. What do you say, Greg?
Practical problem. I mean, it's a fair question to raise. I don't know if it really turns out to be a principled objection against homosexual marriages. If it turns out that people have a legitimate claim to a marriage license, even though they're same-sex partners, then whether or not there is long-term durability to those relationships is irrelevant to the exercise of their right in the moment, it seems to me. Some would argue, and in fact the argument has been made, that even though statistics show that homosexual relationships are very fickle right now, they are not very durable, committed relationships, and they are characterized by promiscuity. Many homosexuals are claiming that if they are allowed to get married, that is, get that piece of paper, that certificate, that verification from the state and culture, then that will stabilize their relationship. So they might make just the opposite. They have, in fact, made just the opposite argument, that homosexual relationships would be more stable rather than less stable with a marriage license. I don't have any reason to think that that's the case, but neither case, I don't know that it's really relevant to the claim that they're making of the propriety of allowing them the liberty to get married, whether or not they get divorced down the line or not.
Paul, stay on hold there. I'd like to send you Greg's book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Very good question. Related to that, and so that we are really clear, and I've heard people say this, look, would homosexual couples want in on the institution of marriage if it had not already been severely degraded by the sexual revolution and what heterosexuals have done to marriage of late, at least in our culture?
Well, apparently they do want in on it, and this is why they've made this great appeal, this great push. It has been part of their objection, in our case, with regards to our resistance, because they say, look, you are claiming that homosexuals will destroy marriage. You guys have already trashed it pretty good all by yourself. And this goes back to what Milana was saying earlier. I think that does raise a problem for us in terms of taking the moral high ground, but it hardly is an argument in favor of same-sex marriage. That's like saying, listen, you've already hit yourself on three fingers. Might as well hit yourself with a hammer on the other two. It doesn't make any sense at all to me.
Listening in Wisconsin Rapids, Marlene is on the line. Marlene, thank you for being patient and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hello.
Hi, Marlene.
Hi. I have a comment and then a question.
Okay.
I don't see how we can stop the homosexuals from getting what they want. I mean, even in Romans 1:24, it says God gave them up to their own foul desires and dishonoring their bodies. I mean, that's what's happening. So I'm wondering, will the marriage amendment ever stop the homosexuals for what they want? And if they do get what they want, what is God going to do? And this is bad.
Well, now this is a very interesting question. In one sense, not only will we not stop them from getting what they want, but they already have what they want. That is, that they have the liberty to live their lives and express their sexual desires, with impunity. There's no restrictions on them at all. What they don't have, and we discussed this in the first hour, is they don't have respect. And this is what they're demanding through marriage licenses, and I think that's what this is all about. So God has, in a sense, God has already given them over. When Paul mentions this in Romans 1, he's saying that's the condition of all those who are living in persistent rebellion against God, of which homosexuals is an example of that, and he uses that in Romans 1. So God has already given them over to pursue their unrighteous proclivities. Now the question is, do we as a culture want to encourage that? I think the answer ought to be no. We shouldn't be encouraging it, and certainly not authenticating it as legitimate, just as on the same level as homosexual, or rather of heterosexual relationships.
Greg, with a minute and a half before our break, into a particular question on the marriage amendment, what are your thoughts on that particular avenue to direct? It's a legal way
right.
of addressing this question.
Well, this is a hard situation because on the one hand, I've heard people argue, and I think there's a lot of merit to this, that the only way to put the brakes on this is an amendment to the Constitution. That is the only way. Because look at what happened in California here, in the City Hall in San Francisco. People don't care what the law says. Look at what the Supreme Court did in Massachusetts. Their ridiculous reasoning on their judgment there against the state of Massachusetts. You know, the judges are just completely out of line, and so we have to have something like a constitutional amendment. But of course, the problem is, the minute they amend the Constitution, this is just another constitutional thing that activist judges can distort. So I think part of the problem, I think certainly we have to have this, because that will be the biggest deterrent that we have access to right now. But we also have to reform the courts. The judges have gone too far in exercise of their power.
We're talking with Greg Kokel, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, responding to same-sex marriage arguments. If you'd like to join us, we've got a few free open lines. 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. When we come back, we'll take your phone calls, continue to take your questions and your comments as time permits. We'll also get to those questions and comments that are posted on our Issues Etc. forum at our website, issuesetc.org, under the What's New section. If you'd like to post a question or a comment there yourself, feel free to do so. issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section. There near the top of the page is a link to our Issues Etc. forum. Greg Kokel is our guest. When we come back, and in addition to your questions and your comments, we need to revisit the whole issue of the family. Something far broader. In the previous hour, Greg talked about redefining the foundation stones. It begins with marriage. It extends to family, to parenting, to children. These are the foundations. Can we change and shift these stones without changing the entire structure of civilization and society? Without being a prophet, what would a future with legal gay marriage look like? We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Do Christians, Jews, and Muslims worship the same God? Can someone worship God the Father apart from Jesus Christ? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. I've written an article for the next edition of the Issues Etc. Journal. It's called Mere Monotheism, and you can receive a complimentary copy of the Issues Etc. Journal by calling our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. What's the difference between a knowledge of God and the true worship of God? Find out with the Issues Etc. Journal, 1-800-737-0172. The next issue also details Dr. Leonard Peyton's journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism, 1-800-737-0172. Now, if you enjoy Issues Etc., the radio show, you need to get the Issues Etc. Journal. Call now, 1-800-737-0172, and ask for a free copy of the Issues Etc. Journal. Next week on Issues Etc., we'll discuss the book of Leviticus with Dr. Andrew Steinman of Concordia University in River Forest, Illinois. In the Old Testament, what's the difference between the ceremonial, the civil, and the moral law? Do all of these laws apply to Christians today? Most importantly, where and how do we find Jesus Christ in the Old Testament and even in the book of Leviticus? We'll talk about all of that next week on Issues Etc. with Dr. Andrew Steinman. Now, if you'd like to know what we'll be discussing for the rest of the month of June, check out our website, issuesetc.org. While you're there, be sure to read Greg Kokel's article, Same-Sex Marriages, Challenges and Responses, the website address, issuesetc.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. We'll let you stay on the line to hear the response to your question or your comment, 1-800-730-2727. Up next, Jose is calling from Daly City, California. Jose, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, thank you, sir. My question is, and why the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah?
Very good question, Jose. Thank you. Greg, let's talk about that Old Testament reference.
Well, this is in the book of Genesis around chapters 19 and following, you have a destruction that is a phenomenal destruction. I mean, a massive judgment against a city for their deeply evil ways. And there are a number of things that were wrong with Sodom and Gomorrah, and we read the prophet Jeremiah talks about some of the faults of Sodom and Gomorrah. But in the account itself in Genesis, we learn one of the things that's true about the people of that community, and that is that the old and the young, the great and the small, were homosexual. So much so that the men that they saw come in to visit Lot, which were in fact angels that appeared as men, they sought from Lot to have these men brought out so that they could have sexual relations with him against their will. And Lot said, don't do this wicked thing. He even offered his daughters. They denied the daughters because they wanted the men. The men, the angels, struck the crowd with blindness, and even when they were blind, they still groped at the door trying to find their sexual satisfaction in these visitors of Lot's household. And as a result of this, God destroyed that city. Now, it wasn't just a result of that particular action, and this is important because some people interpret or understand that action there, this rapacious act, as an inhospitality, and that God wanted to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because they were inhospitable to Lot's visitors. But this could not be the right answer because the decision by God to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah came before this rapacious act. Remember with Abraham and God at the a couple of chapters prior to that where God appeared to Abraham at the Oaks of Mamre, and he tells Abraham what he's about to do because of the great wickedness of that city. And this is when Abraham bargains with him for the 10 righteous men. Turns out there weren't even 10 righteous people. It was a despicable, deplorable city, and one of the great sins of the people of that city was homosexuality. This is unmistakable when you read the text, and you don't have your mind dissuaded by distorted homosexual theology about that passage.
Well, now, one argument that is made, taking into account the Genesis account of Sodom and Gomorrah, and this is sadly made by advocates of gay marriage and other activities like this within the church, and that is, look, okay, the hospitality argument is obviously bogus, but what God condemns in the men of Sodom and Gomorrah is not homosexuality as we know it today. It is that kind of promiscuous, wanton kind of thing. Nowadays, what we're talking about is monogamous, faithful, one-on-one relationships between same-sex men.
It is, Todd, it isn't what they're talking about today. In fact, I had a so-called homosexual pastor on my own radio show once, and I asked him, and though this is anecdotal, it's just one case, it seems to be characteristic, I asked him about homosexual relationships in general, and I said, tell me what kind of homosexual sex you would condemn. And he would not take an issue with any kind of homosexual sex. It isn't as if the homosexual community is saying, yes, our promiscuity is wrong, we realize it, but we want to get married so that we can then have committed relationships like you heterosexuals and not have promiscuous sex. Listen, if you don't make a decision to do that on your own before you get the government's piece of paper, you're not going to make that decision after you get the government's piece of paper. The fact that homosexuals are promiscuous is part of their lifestyle. They're arguing for homosexual liberties per se and not simply just for monogamous relationships.
Mark writes to us from Texas. This is what he has to say. It seems to me at times that we have gone past the most important debate, and having lost, we now must proceed to the secondary argument. Once society decided that it's okay to be gay, it was only a matter of time until the issue of gay marriage was up for vote. Now we argue over what seems so absurd, that people of the same sex should marry. And we've stopped arguing about whether people should pursue any kind of homosexual relationship in the first place. If it's up to the culture, I think the second argument will end much the same way the first one did. We need to return to the first argument more often. What do you think, Greg?
Well, I think his observation is very perceptive. It is the case that we've lost the first couple of rounds, and now we're in new territory, and it's like being pushed back in a battle, and we are just trying to hold the last bit of ground that we have, kind of like the British at Dunkirk, since this is D-Day after all, the British at Dunkirk in the early stages of the war before our invasion at Normandy. It's like we are just trying to hold the last bit of ground that we can hold. I don't think it's going to be helpful, since we're struggling just to be able to hold homosexual marriage at bay, to go backwards now and try to attack homosexuality per se. They've already won that ground in terms of the public approval. We are doing the best we can to hold this bit of ground that we have right now. Whether we're able to do it or not, I don't know. But I don't think we can go backwards and argue against homosexuality. Listen, people, my arguments up until this time principally have been arguments that have not been moral arguments against homosexuality itself. I haven't said homosexuality is wrong, therefore we shouldn't be promoting it in homosexual marriage. the reason I haven't said that is, though I might say that, I think that that argument is going to fall on deaf ears. I'm trying to rescue, as a Christian apologist and defender of culture in a Christian way, what I can from what remains. And therefore, I'm making these more prudential arguments based on what's good for society, because I think that's going to resonate with most people. I think we've lost forever, but certainly tactically or strategically for the moment, we've lost our opportunity to argue on the grounds the gentleman suggests. That day is gone, and we have to face the reality of today and marshal our efforts at the front that the battle is being fought right now, and that is in homosexual marriage. Same-sex marriage.
Yet at the same time, even though, again, on the issue of whether or not we need to marshal moral arguments or not, are there arguments, the same kind of critical thinking, open marketplace of idea, arguments that can be made against homosexuality purely upon the basis, not on the basis of morality, which would be fine and good, we can make those arguments, mm-hmm. but on the basis of the good, whether or not that itself is a good for society?
Yeah, well, I think they can be made, and this is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to say, look, what's the cornerstone of society? It's marriage and family and parenthood. And the reason it's the cornerstone is because families produce cultures. It's families that construct cultures, not the other way around. And therefore, we have to be very, very careful as to what we do with the family. Now, we've been trashing the family for 20 years, and culture has suffered as a result. So what do we do now? Do we continue trashing the family with this next move, or we try to recover a bit, or we try to stabilize the situation as much as we can? That's what I say we should do, and the culture now wants to keep moving forward with this redefinition, and I think this is going to cause more problems. So my argument at this point is prudential. It's what is good for culture. Now, I can only say it's prudential because I understand that God has created family with a certain purpose, and there is a natural order to things that God has established, and that we shouldn't be violating that natural order, and if we do, we do so to our own peril. But I don't have to bring God explicitly into the discussion or start pointing moral fingers at people on the homosexuality issue in order to make that point. And I'm afraid if I did that, it would just ruffle more feathers and would send us backwards.
Greg Kokel is our guest. We'll be right back with him after this. Which of the laws of the Old Testament apply to Christians today, and which do not? More importantly, why don't they? How does a scriptural understanding of Jesus Christ as the fulfiller of the whole law answer these questions? In our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, you'll find answers to these questions, and you'll discover how Christ speaks in the Old Testament. You can order our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus, by calling Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or visit our website, issuesetc.org, and under the What's New section, you'll find information on the Concordia Commentary on the Book of Leviticus. When you call or write, mention Issues Etc. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again. I'm talking with Pastor David Thompson. He's chaplain and program director for the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center. They're going to be holding their Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar June the 6th through the 12th this year. David, what is a Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar?
The Worldview Seminar we have here at the Schwann Center is unique in that it's confessionally Lutheran. In other words, we not only explain to people what's going on in terms of those faulty worldviews that exist out there, but we come at it from a confessional and Lutheran perspective, which is also obviously the biblical perspective as well.
Tell us a bit about some of the topics and the speakers that will be featured at this year's Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar.
We have seven excellent presenters coming here this year, and they include people such as Dr. Gene Edward Veith, who many of your listeners are familiar with, and besides him we have Pastor Jay Weber, who's the rector or the president of the St. Sophia Ukrainian Lutheran Theological Seminary over in the Ukraine, an excellent dogmatics and historical theological presenter. And we also have Pastor Rolf Preuss. We have attorney Craig Parton. We have Professor Alan Quist. And we also have Pastor Todd Wilkin coming here to make a couple presentations as well. We're going to deal with quite a few topics again this year as we did last year. One of the topics we'll be highlighting this year is something called the Confessional and Biblical Worldview, which is presented by Pastor Jay Weber from the Ukraine. And in this particular presentation, he sets the standard against which to measure all other worldviews. We also have Dr. Veith making a presentation on a confessional understanding of the times. In other words, what he's going to talk about there is not only give examples from faulty worldviews such as postmodernism, but he's going to talk about the importance of comparing those worldviews to the confessional and biblical standard, how important that is. Professor Alan Quist will be talking about the worldview battle in American schools. Dr. William Kessel will be speaking about evangelism, as will attorney Craig Parton. And Craig Parton will also be focusing on apologetics.
That's Pastor David Thompson of the Marvin M. Schwann Retreat and Conference Center talking about their upcoming Confessional Christian Worldview Seminar. The seminar is June 6th through the 12th. I'll be speaking there on the Fad-Driven Church. Craig Parton will be speaking about evangelicalism and apologetics, and Dr. Gene Edward Veith will talk about a confessional understanding of our times. The cost is $329, which includes 6 nights lodging and 17 meals. For more information, call 1-800-577-4848 or visit issuesetc.org and look under the What's New section. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about how to respond to same-sex arguments. You'll hear them all over the place with Greg Kokel of Stand to Reason. He's president of Stand to Reason and co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. Now, you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by going first to our Issues Etc. website, issuesetc.org. Under that section titled Links with Regular Guests, you'll find it right there at the website. You'll find a direct link to Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason. Or if you'd like to receive their free Solid Ground newsletter, call Stand to Reason at 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Join us on our forum at our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. The forum is there for your questions and your comments. We're going through a few of those questions posted earlier this week, this evening, last night, on our forum on the issue of same-sex marriage. Here is another. Greg Terry from California writes this. Why should the Christian church care what pagans do in the privacy of their own bedrooms? If homosexuals want the state to allow their claim their immoral lifestyle is a sacrament called marriage, why should it bother us? There are dozens of false religions that the state has now provided tax-exempt status. Civil homosexual unions could easily fall into the same category. Mm-hmm. How do you respond?
Well, I mentioned earlier that people who don't see the impact of this are people who don't understand the power of ideas. In order for, first of all, this has nothing to do with what homosexuals do in the privacy of their own bedrooms. This is a complete misunderstanding. Marriage licenses aren't about what anybody does in the privacy of their own bedrooms. Marriage licenses are about what society says about certain types of relationships. And in order for society to give a marriage license to homosexual couples, they would have to say that, one, there is no such thing as marriage per se, because marriage can be redefined any way we want. Two, there is no such thing as family per se, because family is malleable, can be redefined any way we want. And three, therefore, there is no such thing as parenthood per se. The sexes are completely interchangeable when it comes to all of those things. We can redefine these things any way we want. Now, as I mentioned earlier, it would be naive to say, given that marriage, which starts a family, which produces parents for children, producing the next generation, therefore families being the cornerstone of civilization, and this is true from the beginning of time, whether you start with Genesis or you start with evolution, it's always been the same. It would be naive to say that we can take an axe to the foundation roots of civilization and not suffer the consequences. This isn't about just approving, letting people do whatever they want. This is about redefining the nature of the of civilization. That's what's at stake here. And people who don't see that are not looking carefully.
Someone looks at this and says, well, is this really dragging the church into a political discussion? This issue is political, it's civil, that's what we're talking about, laws here, and therefore the church and Christians in particular really have no business talking about it.
A couple of years ago, there was a gentleman who is a well-meaning and very bright Christian man at the Evangelical Theological Society conference, ETS, that made a similar comment. And he said that there should be nothing, I can't remember exactly how he put it, but nothing political in any of our conversations. There should be no hint of anything political. And so I wrote a piece in response to that, using his phrase as the title of my piece, and here's the problem with that approach. If we say that Christians should not be involved in anything political, we have to make clear what political is. What is a political issue? And it's funny because I remarked at the time that all society has to do is to label some area political, and then Christians then, by conscience, have to opt out. So, killing unborn children, is that a moral issue? No, that's a political issue. Okay, I guess I have to shut up now as a Christian about abortion. And the irony is, as I suggested back then, when they start making statements about male and female relationships in marriage, and they label that political, then we won't have anything to say about that at all. The only thing that we'll be talking about is transubstantiation and consubstantiation and all that kind of stuff. That's what we can discuss on this view. As long as somebody labels, and until somebody labels that a political issue, and then we have to stop talking about that as well. Todd, it's not up to us to let the world decide for us what we have something to say about. It is God's decision. God has given his word. We live by those dictates. And that's why I'm arguing on this particular issue, because God has spoken on this, and we can see the deleterious, harmful effects on culture that will follow when we ignore God's way. And we are trying to put our finger in the dike here and stop this deluge from following. And it is irresponsible of Christians, though it's well-meaning, I understand that, it is right-hearted, but it is wrong-headed, and in fact irresponsible to silence other Christians who speak out on this.
Greg, another listener writes this from Apple Valley, Minnesota. I think it also goes to a topic that is beneath all of this, and that is tolerance and intolerance. Society started to see this as okay, and instead of looking at science, which now says that the genetic argument for homosexuality is void because there is no viable proof that we are born with a certain sexual orientation,
right.
We see it as a norm rather than an absurd and sinful thing. If the country does not act to keep a marriage between a man and a woman, churches may elect not to perform them, and it will be a state issue like Europe. Your response?
Well, there's a lot going on in that comment. Let me just go back to the tolerance and intolerance issue. Whenever those words are raised, I need to have a definition, because these are highly politicized words that are far removed from their original definition. Concept of tolerance in the past was something that was grounded in some substantial way in a Christian worldview. That is, we believed that human beings had innate value, and therefore we were limited in how we were to treat those human beings with whom we disagreed, those human beings who had ideas or conduct that we thought were wrong or immoral. And so therefore, we could disagree with the ideas and even say the behavior was wrong, but still show a certain toleration for the human being by treating that person with a certain type of respect. Okay? Now the word tolerance has become radically politicized, such that respect and tolerance mean that everybody on the outside has to affirm the full legitimacy of every idea and behavior in question. I shouldn't say every idea and behavior, only those that are politically correct, certainly homosexual behaviors. So, if we say that homosexuals are wrong in their behavior, even though we're treating them with respect, we are called intolerant. If we say we don't allow homosexuals to get a marriage license, we are called intolerant. I think this is an abuse of the word. I can be very tolerant of homosexuals. That is, I think they're wrong, and I think their behavior is damaging, and I don't approve of the behavior, nor am I obliged to publicly promote the behavior, yet at the same time, still show grace and kindness and charity and respect for the individuals who are engaged in the behavior. That's the classical sense of tolerance. And every time I hear somebody saying, well, there's a tolerance thing that we have to adhere to, this is where I want to get very, very careful of a definition of the words.
But it really is tied together with the point that you made very early in our conversation, and that is that the sanction of the public and of our system of laws that marriage, formal marriage, would bring to the same-sex couple is not about liberty or justice or love or any of these other things. It is about that sanction.
Yes.
Is it about public approval? It is about dragging marriage into that faulty definition of tolerance.
That's right. You know, the heterosexual couples, I mean, for all the problems that that they've had over the years, in the recent era, the last 20 years or so, with their willingness to live outside of marriage and even now to have children outside of marriage, at least they had something that might be called the courage of their convictions. That is, at the heart of this movement of living outside of marriage, formal marriage, was this idea: we do not need somebody else's approval to verify, justify, legitimize the relationships that we have between ourselves. We legitimize that ourselves. This is not the kind of confidence or courage the homosexual community has demonstrated. And homosexuals have pointed this out as well. Why is it that they must demand that everybody approve of them? Oh, they throw things out like that, well, our safety's at stake and we're dying and getting beaten up and all that other stuff. Well, I think those circumstances are rather rare given the numbers of homosexuals. Characteristically, they are widely accepted and showed a tremendous amount of tolerance in our society. This is not enough for them. And I think the question could be asked, why isn't it enough? I think the answer is, the reason it is not enough for them to have liberty, and instead they demand our overt acceptance, or at least examples of that, through marriage license, is because they don't have the confidence of their own convictions. I actually think homosexuals know that what they are engaged in is deeply immoral, unnatural, and destructive. This is why they don't have the confidence of their own convictions, and this is why they demand that no one say anything that or act in any way that even marginally suggests that there's something amiss in their behavior. They can't take it.
Now, lest we paint with too broad a brush here, and I'm sure you're fully aware of this, there are people who are advocates of the homosexual lifestyle who want nothing to do with gay marriage.
That's true.
They are kind of old-line activists. They say, look, we are legitimate, and we don't need the society to say yes or no to us or to our
right.
Couplings together. And we actually think this could hurt our cause, whatever that cause may
be. Yeah, well, those would be non-activists. Those would be people who ought to just be left alone and let's live and let live. Let us do our thing in our privacy, and you guys do your thing, and let's just live peacefully together. Can't we all get along kind of thing? And they are kind of concerned about the activist types that are demanding so much more and making life, in some ways, they think, more difficult to themselves. And so it's a legitimate distinction. The people that I'm talking about are the ones that are campaigning very strong in a political way for homosexuality, for blanket acceptance of homosexuality, against any suggestion that there can be anything possibly questionable about homosexuality. You know, in Canada, in April, they passed a law. Now it is law in Canada, C-250, parliamentary law. C-250 says that you cannot speak out against homosexuality in a way that might be perceived as fomenting hatred towards homosexuals. Now, of course, you know what that means. It means speaking out against homosexuals at all. So now it's not enough it's an additional step. Now you can't even speak against their behavior. They can't take it. Characteristically, I think that's true of homosexuals.
Greg Kokel is our guest. When we come back, more of your emails as well. What about, to extend the slippery slope argument, that if we have gay marriage and redefine marriage, we will be able to include anything and everything under that for all sorts of reasons? We'll have more of your email, your questions, your comments after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever finished reading a Bible book but then felt frustrated because several of your questions went unanswered? Well, you'll find a helpful resource when studying the Old Testament book of Leviticus with the New Concordia Commentary on Leviticus. It's our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June. You can find out more about this commentary under the What's New section of our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. That's 1-800-325-3040. The Concordia Commentary on Leviticus costs $42.99 plus shipping and handling. How does each chapter of Leviticus find its fulfillment in Jesus Christ? And what was the purpose of the detailed instructions in the so-called divine speeches of Leviticus? Find out with a Concordia Commentary on Leviticus by Dr. John Kleining, 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for June, the Concordia Commentary on Leviticus.
We're talking about same-sex marriage and the arguments made in favor of it and the responses to those arguments. Greg Kokel is our guest, president of Stand to Reason in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. Another listener writes this, Greg: can you imagine the money to be made in gay separations? The palimony cases that will be most interesting and beneficial to the legal industry, the legal system will enjoy this movement. What will keep children from marrying their own parents in order to collect Social Security? You say, what? I will be able to have two or three marriage partners, and why can't one be my elderly father? If he passes on before me, my wife and I can enjoy his Social Security death benefits. Well, some people just might try that. The frog is boiling. This is the punishment, Dr. Dobson would say. Once marriage is redefined, any person can marry any other people. Why not siblings, etc.?
Well, my response to that, actually, there is a homosexual response to that, and I mentioned it earlier, and the homosexuals will say, well, those kinds of things are just ridiculous. And I agree with them. They are ridiculous, but which is precisely the point. If it turns out that you hold a view that when properly and consistently applied in other circumstances leads to ridiculous conclusions, it begins to look like something's wrong with your view. And this is exactly what we're facing. If, in fact, marriage and family and parenthood are mere social conventions that can be redefined any way we want, what is to stop us from redefining it any way we want or in the ways that you just described? Why not? In my files here, I've got an article about a woman who just married herself, for goodness sake, in Sweden. In France this year, a woman married the corpse of her fiancé that was dead for a year, and Jacques Chirac signed off on that one. Why not? These are the kinds of things that happen when the norms are denied. It follows completely from the rationale that homosexuals have made for same-sex marriage. For the very same reasons that they've offered for same-sex marriage, all of these other polygamy, polyandry, all of these, you know, like I said earlier, rub-a-dub-dub, 3 men in a tub and a potted plant, why not? It's wide open once you say that there's no normative definition to marriage.
One more listener's email, and then I have two final questions for you,
okay.
Greg. This is Frank from Las Vegas. It seems strange to me that little is being said about the public health issues involved in homosexuality. Other social costs involved with homosexuality need to be addressed. This is the only way to argue to the world convincingly regarding homosexuality in general and gay marriage in particular. Your response?
I don't think it's the only way to argue, but I do think it's a good way to argue. It's an external type of argument. That means it's an argument made not using the Bible directly. Basically, the argument goes like this: homosexuality itself, as a practice, as a behavior, is inherently unhealthy, and it has consequences for health for those who are not engaged in the behaviors. In other words, when homosexuals say, "I'm not hurting anyone else. I'm just doing, you know, what I want for my life, and I'm not hurting anyone else," that's simply wrong. They are hurting other people. The AIDS crisis and the infected blood banks that we have right now are a result, to a great degree, of homosexuals doing whatever they want as long as it's not hurting somebody else. I think this is a very powerful argument where you're not even bringing in any moral argument with regards to homosexuality itself. You're just simply saying, look, why should we be encouraging this behavior? It's dangerous, and it influences other people that aren't involved in the behavior. We ought to do everything we can to discourage it without harming the individuals involved.
There is an argument that is made by both the advocates of gay marriage and those who would just prefer not to think about it or kind of take a more libertarian view, and that is, look, the fact that two men may want to marry in my state or some other state has absolutely no effect on my marriage. It's not going to hurt my marriage between me and my wife or my family. How do you respond to this?
Well, they're probably right. It isn't going to hurt their marriage. Neither will blowing up innocent people in Iraq hurt their marriage or hurt them directly. It doesn't mean that the behavior is a good one, though. My argument is that this is the, and this is why I said earlier, people who defend this have two problems. One, they don't understand the implication of or the impact of ideas on culture, and secondly, they think if it doesn't hurt them tomorrow, then it's not going to hurt anybody in the future. It's like no fault divorce. You know, people who were married at the time of no fault divorce when it was promoted 20 years ago probably thought, gee, this isn't going to hurt my marriage. I'm not going to get divorced, and maybe they never did, but a whole lot of people did. For inappropriate reasons, leaving all kinds of latchkey children that are now adults and are messed up and are doing the same thing their parents did. This has an influence on culture, and the ideas matter. They make a difference, and it's just, again, I have to emphasize Melinda Penner's comment, it is naive to think that we won't suffer down the line when we tamper with these things. Maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next week, but how could we actually believe that we can undermine and redefine the very foundations of society and not experience the consequences later? That's just foolishness.
Then without too much prognostication or speculation, you talked earlier about shifting the foundation stones of marriage, of family, parenting,
right,
and children, and not being able to do that without some consequence. You just said that,
right,
again.
Right.
What would a future society with legally recognized same-sex marriage look like from the foundation up?
This is a hard one to say, and because we don't have many analogs in modern culture. You can look at Sweden, you can look at the Netherlands, you can look at countries like that that have highly liberalized laws with regards to homosexuality and, in fact, have de facto homosexual marriage. And you can see that the marriage, that the family has been in decline for years. It doesn't mean that homosexuality is the sole cause of that or same-sex unions is the sole cause of that, but certainly it's a contributing cause. This seems to me absolutely obvious. But think about it, Todd. 20 years ago now, let me think, this is 2004, 1984, homosexuals said, listen, what we do in the privacy of our own bedroom has nothing to do with anyone else. This was in a time at that time when nobody had ever heard of AIDS, AIDS, and autoimmune deficiency syndrome. Now we know that what they thought they were doing in the privacy of their own home that wasn't hurting anybody turned out to hurt a lot of people. We do not know the impact of our proclivities in the future. And this is why the wisdom of ages, again, I'll emphasize, whether one takes this from a theological perspective or just a cultural perspective, why is it the cultures have done it this way from time immemorial? It seems that there's a reason for it. At our peril, we disrupt that. We can't always anticipate the trouble that we're going to cause when we depart from that which is good and sound and true. We can get some ideas, but we don't know how bad it could be. That's reason enough not to upset the apple cart, in my view. Even if I don't know for sure the bad things that are going to happen, why take the risk?
Greg Kokel, thank you for being our guest on Issues Etc.
Todd, it's been my pleasure, and give us a call anytime.
We will. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-authored the book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. If you'd like to receive a complimentary free copy of our Issues Etc. journal, or if you'd like to know how to contact Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason, or if you'd like to join our Issues Etc. Reformation Club by becoming a monthly supporter to this worldwide outreach, call our resource line 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or write us at Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. That's Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. We are talking, in essence here, about the pervasive effect of our sin upon society. So let's get one thing straight as we close up here tonight. Even if we are able to prevent same-sex marriage from having its way in our laws, our institutions, our culture, and our society, by some means, by these arguments, by means of a constitutional amendment or getting the right lawmakers or laws made, we will not forestall the detrimental effects of our sin in society. The real root of this is not just the homosexual who's out there doing something behind closed doors. The real root of this, and the real problem that we face here, is not one that can be solved with laws or amendments or even arguments. The real root of this is the sin that is inherent in all of us. It expresses itself in some in the perverse proclivities of homosexuality and the desire to have things their way, even to the institution of marriage and the family. It expresses itself in others like us in other ways,